Welcome to The Digital Shift. I'm Jenny Weindorp, Director of Development and Engagement here at NHS Providers. This mini-series explores how senior leaders in the health sector can confidently lead their organisations in the shift from analogue to digital. We'll explore topics such as how to harness data, the importance of understanding cyber risks, and what leaders need to do differently to drive progress in the digital age. In each episode, we'll be joined by senior leaders and experts who have led impactful and lasting change in complex organisations. Our host, Chris Fleming, a partner at Public Digital and delivery partner of our Digital Boards and Digital ICS programmes, will draw out practical advice and solutions by digging into the how leaders navigated the challenges of organisation-wide change, and how you can set your teams up for success. In this episode, our host Chris is joined by Audrey Fletcher, a director at Public Digital. Audrey leads digital transformation programmes for major public sector organisations and has worked with the Home Office, UK Parliament and Ofcom. They look at the challenges facing leaders in driving forward digital delivery in times of uncertainty and pressure, particularly drawing on Audrey's experience as former service director at NHS Test and Trace, where she led the development and rollout of the service. Chris and Audrey reflect on her learning from leading this major digital programme in an unprecedented and rapidly changing environment, and how you can lead in a time of change. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, I'm Chris Fleming, partner at Public Digital, where I lead our healthcare practice. My previous career was in digital delivery and transformation in the NHS. And today, just as it did back then, the NHS faces major changes. It's, if you like, at the mercy of the combination of government funding, political ambition, the whims of ministers, and ever-changing health, social, economic priorities. And some of the most incredible and committed teams I've worked with having to continue to respond rapidly to whatever the next most pressing thing is. To be a successful leader in the health sector and continue to make real progress in terms of delivery, navigating change is a non-negotiable skill, a prerequisite for all leadership level roles. And of course, in recent history, the COVID-19 pandemic was a period of huge uncertainty and pressure for the health service. But digital product service platforms and delivery was absolutely essential in delivering life-saving services such as NHS Test and Trace. So I'm very grateful that today Audrey is going to share her experiences of delivering that service, as well as drawing on extensive experience in her career, and give us some thoughts on what leaders can do to continue to make progress and continue to deliver in uncertain, changing, and often extremely stressful times. Welcome, Audrey. Hello.
Hi, Chris.
So I'm going to ask you today how you managed to deliver such a hugely important piece of work at NHS Test and Trace during what felt like nothing we'd really experienced before. And what I'm hoping is that by the end of this episode, listeners will know what to do so they feel more comfortable managing in uncertainty, and recognize what's in their control and what their time and energy is best spent on. So what we're going to do, Audrey, is we're going to start with some quickfire statements. And the plan here is you can only give me one word answers. It's hard to lead when there's lots of uncertainty.
False.
More pressure calls for more command and control leadership.
No.
Wait for the right time and the perfect conditions before you start a big piece of work.
Pointless.
If an organisation-wide crisis hits, business as usual work must be abandoned.
Disaster.
A leader's success can only be measured in metrics and deliverables.
It depends. Two words, sorry.
That's all right. We'll let you off. Burnout is an inevitable part of dealing with uncertainty.
Not inevitable.
And next, I'm going to ask you what you think the biggest misconception is about the role leaders play in helping their teams to deliver in a changing environment. And don't feel restricted to one word here. You can feel free to give me a longer answer for this one.
I think leaders quite often try and provide directive leadership behaviour just at the point things are starting to, you're starting to feel like you lose control. Their instincts are to tighten the reins, which I think is really counterproductive. You don't want to direct every chess move on the chessboard for your organisation. Instead, you want people who know which gambit you're playing. While we were in Test and Trace, the executive team read a book called Team of Teams. It was written by an army general, and he made the point that it's chaos when you are in a war. And rather than direct every single person, what you have to do is have teams of teams. Everybody needs the North Star. They need to know what direction they're collectively going in. They need a shared consciousness, and they need the tools, the skills to be able to do what they have to do. But you're essentially saying, this is what we're collectively trying to achieve. The conditions are unpredictable. They're going to change. But I have faith that we'll be able to get to what it is that we're trying to achieve. And then you give them this empowered autonomy.
I just want to follow up right away with a question, which is really a practical one, which is, to use your analogy, helping the team understand the gambit you're playing, what are the kind of techniques that leaders might use to achieve that alignment?
We were told that we needed to make sure that underrepresented groups were testing more so that we could reduce incidents in the areas that were stubbornly overrepresented in the incidence figures. We were not told precisely how to make our testing services more inclusive. With that as an outcome, you can start running experiments. We pulled together a very long list of accessibility improvements that needed to be made to our online and offline services and started building them into a roadmap. But as Lara Sampson often says, the plan is only the plan until it changes. And, you know, while roadmap regularly changed, having it there was part of the point in the first place, though. It is an artifact that represents a shared understanding, a shared consciousness of your best theory for how you're going to achieve the outcomes that you've set out. The best leaders I have seen, they're realistic optimists. They say up front, the plan is going to change as soon as we learn something that tells us that this is not the best option anymore. And that's okay. As long as we're collecting what we need to learn intelligently, that we're not making the same mistakes over and over again, then it's not failure. It's learning. It's progress. Ruling things out, that's progress. So the best leaders I know create that culture of psychological safety. They use things like the retrospective prime directive to make sure that there isn't a blame culture, to make sure that teams can reflect together and improve how they're working towards that North Star.
I couldn't agree more with that. And a note to listeners, there will be information in the show notes around the book you mentioned, Audrey, Team of Teams, and the Retrospective Prime Directive, which also a big fan of that.
The directive itself is that regardless of what we discover, we must understand and truly believe that everyone did the best job they could have, given what they knew at the time, their skills and abilities, the resources available, and the situation at hand. I like to use at the start of difficult meetings and workshops where I think people might get defensive or start blaming others.
I wanted to pull at this thread a little bit more about the creating psychological safety for change. What are your reflections on managing an inevitably unpredictable and changing environment in a context where there's a cultural appetite for what you might deem false certainty sometimes?
The more exposure I've had through leadership positions to the central functions, and specifically the leadership of central functions, the clearer it is to me that they are usually very pragmatic when it comes to reality. If you are not overcommitting to things that are patently undeliverable, and if you flag that something is a hypothesis or an experiment. So we got funding to roll out anonymous testing. The hypothesis was, if we don't collect details of people who in person take test kits from us in disproportionately impacted areas, will we have a higher take up of testing in those areas? So we didn't ask for funding for the rollout of that for 6 months or a year or nationwide. We didn't go to full scale. We got permission to spend a certain number of test kits and a certain amount of money, and we learned that it didn't work. That was really powerful. And finance was completely behind it because they understood that we didn't and couldn't have all of the answers at the start. And to be frank, most commercial and finance directors across the wider public sector, including the NHS, will have seen very large programmes fully funded but under-tested or on really shaky assumptions, committing to roll out of a big thing, and then they spend a lot of time and a lot of money delivering the wrong thing. Delivering something that shouldn't be delivered, that isn't going to have the impact that you want, but doing it on time and on budget, that's poor management, that's poor leadership, that shouldn't happen.
That's certainly resonating with me. I just want to jump back to the word you mentioned earlier, empowerment. And in our quickfire section, we talked about the instinct to go more command and control in periods of pressure is not necessarily the right one. How do you get the balance right between empowering teams, but making sure that they're aligned with an overall goal, vision, and delivering the right thing?
That's a really great question. Some leaders don't empower their teams because they don't have faith that their teams aren't going to make the wrong calls. So what do you do? Well, you need to make sure that you have established that shared understanding of what it is that you're trying to achieve and why. You can then move on to making sure that they actually have the skills, capability to deliver what it is. So if you give teams something small that is within their sphere of control enough that they don't have to be massively dependent on other people, that it is within their skill set, maybe at the edge of their skill set, and something that they can achieve relatively quickly, you can grow their confidence in their ability to deliver it. Seeing that you have actually delivered a thing that you said that you were going to deliver that was different to the way that you've delivered in the past, that has a momentum of its own, and it shows people different ways of working. They grow their ability to do these sorts of things. Massively boosts a team's sense of agency. The other thing I said is that leaders might not have faith that people will make the right calls. Actually, I think leaders themselves need to accept that that is part of the risk of having teams that actually get things done. Yeah, they have to make calls. No one is going to make the right calls all of the time. You focus on de-risking it. You focus on the impact of them making the wrong calls being smaller. You focus on your teams are radiating their intentions rather than seeking permission for everything. But that doesn't mean that they're working in the dark. Doesn't mean that you're not going to be able to stop things going off a cliff. I think leaders that are worried about people making the wrong calls occasionally are going to end up with teams that don't really make any. And that's not how things happen.
During our quickfire round, Audrey, I challenged that if an organisation-wide crisis hits, business as usual work must be abandoned. And you pointedly said, disaster. Tell us more.
The idea that you can stop in a crisis and just have a big thing is wild. It's policy in their ivory towers, strategy in their ivory towers. When there are changes that are going to hit and you need to be able to move quickly, what you want are teams with the ability to change things quickly. Your operational teams are the ones that will be able to provide you with the challenge that you really need to know whether or not something is a goer. So the idea of stopping business as usual in order to do that it did generate that reaction from me. But that doesn't mean that you have to continue doing all business as usual, because that assumption just generally needs to be battered away. I have enjoyed working in organisations that took the opportunity of a crisis to stop doing things that shouldn't be done. So that's another way of looking at it. Right at the start of COVID, I was working with the Department for Education, and we decided to stop all school data returns. Just temporarily. It was unimaginable that we might stop asking for any data, to be honest, because you know what central governments departments are like. But we had accumulated so many data streams over decades. A lot of it stopped being relevant, but there was nobody whose job it was to say, why are we still collecting this? So the burdens on schools just increase and increase. We'd identified the things that we absolutely needed to continue to collect information on, like school attendance and home learning provision, and schools with access to Wi-Fi, and things like that, so that we could effectively respond to COVID as a crisis, and so that we could continue to meet the statutory responsibilities that we knew we were going to be held to account on. And the nice thing about this was on the other side of it, you end up having something that was better than you had pre-crisis because you have stripped away things, you have challenged things. It was really taking the opportunity to build back better rather than hitting the brakes or continuing to add to the workload, to your work in progress, and never actually challenge whether or not some of the stuff you're doing ought to have been stopped anyway. I highly recommend.
Yeah. Thank you, Audrey. And I know that there will likely be vigorous nodding amongst trust leaders about querying the value of some of the incessant data collections that can get issued from central teams. But moving on, we talked about burnout. And I know this is a podcast about digital leadership, but just to get into some aspects of team health, which become really, you know, essential to keep delivery going. You said that burnout is not an inevitable part of dealing with uncertainty. Can you say more about that?
I'm sure there are decades of research. I know there are decades of research that talk about burnout and what causes burnout. And within them, it does recognize that work overload plays an important part. And I don't want to downplay the impact of not prioritizing effectively, not delegating effectively. Being a perfectionist can have on a leader. And if these are any of your habits, I strongly encourage you to work on them. That said, we're talking about the leadership of teams too. We're not just talking about individuals. And burnout is more than just work overload. It can be caused by the sense of a lack of control, lack of understanding what it is that you're trying to achieve or the resources to be able to do it. It can be caused by people not feeling valued, by toxic work environments, by a sense of unfairness in how people are being treated. So there's a quite a big emotional, psychological element to burnout that is not related to whether or not we have enough hours in the day. We never have enough hours in the day. And I think people in a leadership position can have an impact on those things. If you identify the problems, if you do temperature checks on your teams, if you are creating that culture of openness and giving people the opportunity to speak up and showing repeatedly that it is safe to do so, that you are happy to be challenged, you can make decisions that you justify and are applying even-handedly and that people can get on board with even if they don't really agree. And the safer you can make the environment that people work in, the more you'll have people that can deal with the work overload. It's quite a heavy responsibility. And when you are feeling under stress and tense, you might become your worst self as a leader rather than your best self. So I've always found getting access to a coach in the pinch points of my career has helped me be a better leader in the workplace, and for precisely that reason.
That's a great tip. Or you're just referring back to our quickfire answers, and you said that it was pointless, really, to wait for the right time and perfect conditions before you start a big piece of work. Tell us a bit about that.
There's no such thing as the right time or perfect conditions. It's like having kids, you know? It doesn't exist. There will never be a best time for this. Quite often, the right conditions are related to risk aversion. People are waiting for more evidence to convince them that this is the right approach. Actually, they're not recognizing that they're in analysis paralysis. We just need a stronger business case for this. We just need a bit more evidence that this is the right thing. You can't always have that level of certainty. In fact, you rarely can have that level of certainty. And so often I look back on things that we've done where I've waited for something and think, we could have started that a month earlier. Why did we wait? So sometimes it is best to just start working through it. Start delivering. If it's the wrong thing to deliver, usually that will show itself quite quickly. Small things, they reveal opportunities that you might never have thought of if you were trying to think your way to the right answer before you start doing it. So learning through doing is really, really valuable because it shows you much more. Also, I find the whole just do it approach helps me to say no to things. Quite a lot of what we've talked about is relates to how overwhelmed people might feel in a crisis, and managing your work in progress is quite an important part of that. I find lots of leaders I've worked with have spent far too much of their energy and political capital trying to persuade someone not to do something, trying to persuade a minister or trying to persuade a chief executive not to do something. actually, I have managed to bat off an awful lot of silly ideas by trying it out, putting a prototype in front of actual customers, doing some usability testing with real prospective users, some A-B testing to show that actually this is worse than the thing we currently have. It is harder for people to debate actual evidence of how people will really respond to a thing. If you don't want to start a piece of work, sometimes the best way to avoid it is to start the piece of work, but do it in a way that will quickly show that it's the wrong thing. And occasionally, I've been wrong. And the person I was working for was absolutely right, and it was a better idea. So that happens too. But yeah, sometimes it's the service equivalent of asking Google rather than arguing it out, just see what the answer is. It doesn't always take that long.
That was brilliant. Okay, just to wrap up, what we're going to do now is return to the quickfire questions. And this time, I'm going to be generous and allow a whole sentence to respond to them. It's hard to lead when there's lots of uncertainty.
It is hard to lead people that demand certainty in uncertainty. So grow people that don't demand certainty. Work with them in a different way.
More pressure calls for more command and control leadership.
It's often the opposite of what you need when the pressure is caused by complex, unpredictable environments. So if your pressure is causing that, go for shared consciousness instead. Go for empowering teams instead. Don't focus on silos and tightening control. Find a safer way to release the reins slightly to get better results.
If an organization-wide crisis hits, business as usual work must be abandoned.
If your business as usual work is fundamental to outcomes that you will still need to deliver during the crisis, then you would never abandon it.
A leader's success can only be measured in metrics and deliverables.
A leader's success should be measured in whether or not they're delivering the right things, first of all. Is it effective? Is it impactful? Does it deliver those outcomes? And only then worry about whether or not it's on time or on budget, because there's no point delivering the wrong thing on time or on budget.
Burnout is an inevitable part of dealing with uncertainty.
Leaders need to work first on themselves, on their overload, on their leadership style when they're under pressure, on how they might be able to help improve the work culture. But I think it never is just work overload. It's so much more than that. Leaders are in the perfect position to support and shift the morale of teams and help them deal with that sense of burnout.
Wait for the right time and perfect conditions before you start a big piece of work.
There is no such time. There are no such conditions. If you wait, you will find yourself wishing that you had started sooner.
Thank you, Audrey. That was an incredibly insightful discussion on making progress in uncertain times. As I said at the top of the podcast, this really is so relevant to the NHS right now. So I'm certain this will be extremely useful to our listeners. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Chris. It was great talking to you today.
That's it for this episode of The Digital Shift. You can find relevant and related content in the show notes if you'd like to delve deeper into some of the things mentioned in this episode. And if you'd like to find out more about how our digital support offers can help you in your role, head to NHS Provider's website. Thanks for listening.